I don't know, like it's difficult for me to like assume the information I'm reading are real because I'm talking about
Right.
in realness.
But you're talking about the fiction of Western science also, which,
Exactly.
it posits itself as having the grasp on reality and the truth, but science is always changing its story.
And also, like, what we understand about reality is the fiction.
That's right.
So when I talk about the non-reality, I'm not saying that things don't exist. I'm just saying that, like, the explanations of the existence may not be what we think they are. Welcome to the Embodied Astrology Podcast. My name is Gaps404 and I work at EA as the Audiovisual Creative Director, producing images and videos. I'm also at the Facilitators Core Team this year, and starting on May 4th, I'll be leading the Nebula Lab, a series where we will explore the Neptunian un/reality through photography and image. For this podcast episode, I invited René Sils, who you probably know as the host of this podcast. René is a multidisciplinary artist, author, astrologer, educator, and founder of Embodied Astrology. They are a second-generation astrologer and lifelong student of somatic healing practices. Before listening to this episode, I just want to say that this is my first time as a host, and as someone who has Neptune at the midheaven, I feel I led our conversation in a very Neptunian way. If you'd like to know more or register at the Nebula Lab, please go to embodiedastrology.com. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoy. Well, I called you here so we could talk a bit about Neptune,
Yay.
and I think it's an interesting conversation because I feel that from all the signs, Neptune may be the least, how can I say this? The least talkable, sign. Like, so it's the one that it's so difficult to put in language because all the associations we do with Neptune are much more symbolic and even non-visual. So I think it's tricky to talk about something that's difficult to see in our mind. But as someone that really works, with the body, I think you can bring this bodily intelligence to the conversation too.
Yeah, that's interesting. The symbolism of astrology is so vast, and within the delineations of the signs and the planets and the aspects or the houses or all these different ways that we categorize symbolism, they're all constrained by language. Like any category that we're going to make, any conception that we're going to make is constrained by what we're able to conceive of. And like the linguistic capacity is such a big part of conception. And I think that there's this interesting space between what is possible inside of the liminal imaginal, which is definitely sensory and of the dream and in the spirit and in the in-between, but it isn't yet formed. And then, the space of what has been formed, come into language, come into a poem, come into a song, or given a shape of some kind. And yeah, Neptunian symbolism, and for sure the symbolism of Pisces as its associated sign, I think they're trying to express the unformedness. And so then anything that we're grasping at as a form to explain the unformed is always going to fall short.
Exactly. And this reminds me that yesterday I was watching this film about the infinite. So I was sick and I was like, I need to do something that's, like not working or thinking. And then all of a sudden I was watching a film about the infinite. But what you're saying made me think about like this feeling of like the infinite. It's something that even when we try to imagine, it's impossible to imagine that the problem about like when we try to imagine the universe is that we try to imagine like being above it and seeing it under us. And you cannot think, because if you are above it, that means you are still in the universe. And you cannot imagine or see it if not like all around you. And hence the impossibility of like imagining something like so big.
I mean, I think that that's the paradox. Like, that is the bottleneck of any conceptual process. You know, to conceive of something is to place it outside of yourself, right? To put language around something, to have a description, to understand how something works, you know, is to remove yourself from the process of it. And also to just, you know, to flatten things in such extreme ways. Like, even the concept of understanding the universe, right? Like, the concept of the universe at all as something that is a thing, you know, emerges from an imagination or a lack of imagination, maybe, that wants to limit and confine and put into boxes. And the truth of the phenomenal existence, including the universe, including our bodies, including any concept that I might be trying to describe, is that there's no fixed form to it. You know, it's not a thing. It is an essence. It is an evolution. And as soon as we try and say, oh, that's what that is, or this is who you are, or this is what I am, or this is what that word means, you know, it's like we imagine that it's done, it's dead, it's not living, and it's something that we can separate out of existence as a whole and put in some kind of vacuumed environment where it won't keep changing, where it won't have its life essence. And then from that place, you know, that we would have this kind of supreme perspective and be able to explain or understand what it is.
Yeah, totally. But then when you do this, like when you put something in the vacuum, are you out of it? Because if you are out of it to watch it, then where you are is also part of that. And again, like you're trapped in this thing of like trying to imagine something being outside of it. And I think this is exactly what language does. It's like the moment we try to explain, we already don't have it anymore.
That's right.
No, I was just thinking about like how, you know, like Neptune is connected to spirituality and, you know, like, and how spirituality is much more like a feeling and you cannot explain sometimes. And dreams also, you know, when you have a dream and you're like, some way something happened and you don't know how to explain how that thing happened in your dream because it's not explainable. But you know it happened.
That's right. I feel like that's in some ways the reason why, on a subtle experiential level of, you know, Neptunian energy, like when you read about how to work with your Neptune placement, you know, or your Pisces placement, or we're having a Neptune transit, and like, what are you supposed to do? And again and again and again and again in all the books and all the astrologers' interpretations, you're going to come across meditative activities of some kind, spiritual activities of some kind. And the thing that you do in meditation or in many meditation practices, like the kind of baseline foundation of shamatha, you know, like a calm abiding practice, is to observe the observer, right? So it's like you're sitting there on your cushion, you're trying to meditate, and your mind is doing the thing that your mind does, which is jumping from one point to another point to another point to another point in its own associative, illogical logic, in its own loops and patterns. And your body is going to do the thing that it does, which is to get anxious and lethargic, to experience pain, you know, to go to sleep, to what, you know, experience hunger, to have to use the bathroom. And then your emotional body is going to be responding to the sensations of your mind and your physical body, right? And your mind is jumping from the pain that you feel in your left knee to that memory of the time that you hurt your knee playing basketball. And then your emotional body is experiencing that injury all over again. And then it's making you think about how your like boyfriend didn't show up to help care for you. And then you're going to feel that and go on that loop, you know? And it's like, this is what our consciousness does. And we conceive of things from that place. Like most of conceptual processes, like are conceiving through a filter of mental, physical, emotional, and phenomenological observation. But what a meditation practice does is it asks you to observe who's observing, right? Not try and stop your thoughts. Not try and stop your body from having sensations, but notice the subtle quality of the essence that is observing these sensations. And then to get really curious about what is that essence? You know, what consciousness allows this experience of this passing moment? And in that practice, what builds then is a cultivation of awareness of ephemerality, right? Like things are happening, sensations are spilling into one another, and they'll continue to spill into one another forever. But then there's this consciousness, right? Like there's this subtle presence that can observe it all happening, but also is created by, but also is not of. Right. And it's like, oh, I start to realize that I am not my thought. I am not the pain in my knee in the way that I might identify in a moment of emotional activation, right? And a grasping to it. Oh, I have this concept, right? I have this concept of pain. And in my concept of pain, I have a preference. I don't like it. I want it to stop. And then I identify with that, and all my actions start to orient towards my preference. But practicing meditation, pain is here. And so are these emotions, and so are these thoughts. And oh, wow, look at how they want to express. Look at what wants to happen. Feel the living nature of pain as it's emerging in this particular moment. And when you do that, when you can drop into that, all time gets collapsed, right? And it spreads out. It's like, oh, all of that is here right now. And that doesn't get confined in a concept, right? Like of a knee injury. It doesn't get confined in a concept of like what someone is or what the universe is, you know? Again, to conceive of like what is the universe. The only way to actually even start to conceive of that is to be absolutely present with the universe that is alive inside of our bodies. You know, we can't, like you're saying, it's like we can't get out of it. We're absolutely inside of it. So, you know, the struggle of describing something is also the struggle of experiencing it. And this key word, you know, of meditation, of spirituality, of the subtle, of the numinous that comes up with Neptune, I think is pointing at, if you want to understand it, you have to be with it. You know, you have to experience it. And your understanding will just continue to evolve from there. It's not going to be something that then you can turn around and write a book about. I mean, you can, plenty of people have, but you know, their experience will not be the last word. It's like this quality of presence that can contain all of the different dimensions is the quality that we're trying to describe.
Yeah, 100%. And it makes me think as well. It's like if you write a book about it, You're again falling into language and words, and like it is impossible to like observe as you're saying the experience without experimenting that thing. So you can read everything about meditation. If you do not meditate, you will never know how it is. And I think Neptune in this way is, as you're saying, just being with it. And then like this thing about like being with it is that we tend to like search for answers and explanations for what is the universe and things like that outside. But then again, when you're meditating, part of the process is searching inside. And then when you search inside, it's almost like you are like reversing things. So like as if the universe was the inside of you, and then like everything that is around you is like this tiny little thing that is contained in your flesh or something like that. Which makes me think like of, like one of the associations with Neptune is like the oneness where everything's connected. And then I was also thinking about like these meditations that uses like
Chanting mantra.
chanting. Yeah, chanting. We don't have a word for this in particular, so I keep forgetting. So when meditating, and I did some meditations that we needed to chant, and the thing about like the words is that when you keep repeating them, they are so important because they lose their meaning, and not because they have. The meaning of chanting is like expand the words until like they don't mean anything. They're just this sound,
The
this
frequency,
vibration. Yeah.
vibration.
So I started this in a very Neptunian way, just talking a bit. But I think we can come back, and I just want to say that part of why we are here talking about this is because this year at Embodied Astrology, I started investigating what is Neptune bringing while it's traveling at the very last part of Pisces, especially 29 degrees, which is the aneretic degree or a critical degree, and thinking about this as a preparation of something that is forming, but also as something that exists by itself. So not only, like not only trying to think in this like productivity way of like, oh, something is forming and we need to be prepared, but like something is forming and something being forming is what already exists. So a bit of what you were saying about like the universe and like the ever expansion and the capacity of changing. And then thinking about this also because Pluto is traveling between Aquarius and Capricorn in these critical degrees as well. So the last and the first degrees, the last degree of Capricorn and the first degree of Aquarius. And with all the outer planets changing signs until 2026, yeah, just feeling like this amount of energy of change. So thinking about this as I work with images, I wanted to explore Neptune through visualities and photography, especially not only because I'm a photographer, but one of the associations of Neptune is photography. And the workshop, well, a workshop is more like this lab to explore with other people that is called the Nebula Lab. It will start in May and it will last until December. And once a month, we'll have encounters to, talk about different, topics and themes that I'm exploring this year and that I want to talk with and about with other people. So some of the themes are what is Neptune, the myth of Neptune and the dream lab, queer time. So is queer time as a way of thinking that time is an illusion. The chronological time that we live today was created, and queer in time would be like to understand what are the other forms of living different times and travel between time. You know, like if this time is created, this means we can create other types of time. Post-truth and artificial intelligence, Neptune in the birth chart, the generational aspects of Neptune. And if all of these encounters, I will bring some exercises with photography and visual arts. And then we will build this collective principle zine that I'm really excited about. But anyway, so I called you here so we can talk a bit about time. Before the recording started, I was telling you like that I consider myself a very experimental astrologer. And you know, like I think you are too an experimental astrologer, but you have much more technique and base than I do with astrology. And you of course study and practice astrology for a longer time than I do. And I think there is something very interesting, Renee, that is like you're talking about, like this is the moment for us to create new myths. We are done with the myths that were created. They no longer serve us, if they ever did. So yeah, can you introduce a bit of yourself and what are you thinking?
Yes, thank you. I'm so excited for the Nebula Lab this year. Yeah, I'm also deeply an experimental astrologer. And it's a lifelong study and passion of mine as well. I grew up very influenced by astrology. My mom was an astrologer and a healer, a body worker, and an herbalist. And when I was about 8, she went back to school and she hadn't gone to college. She finished her college degree and then became a therapist, a counselor, and merged all of the things that she did in parenting me. And I have, in my own chart, I have Neptune conjunct the South Node in Sagittarius in my fifth house. And one way that I like to think about that is just having had a kind of lifetime of support around creative synthesis and a lot of support to dissolve and play with philosophy and, you know, spirituality and religious practices. My mother was a deeply spiritual person, and she was also a highly creative person, and so took a lot of liberties in blending, which occurred to her as divine. And so, yeah, like in the way that I do astrology, I really come from a background of synthesis and exploration and wanting to merge these different fields. And I think one of Neptune's great keywords is merging, you know, and this kind of becoming, unbecoming, becoming again, unbecoming again, that is this, you know, sense of the liminal space. I really resonate with that. And I think astrology as a practice is that, you know, it has been a practice that has accompanied human civilization since humans had civilization. And the ways that we tell stories about our surroundings are how we build our civilizations. And so astrology is grounded in mythos and logos, right? Like these stories and thoughts and concepts that emerge from human beings relating with their environments and each other. And observing different characteristics embedded inside of nature, whether that's inside of a season or inside of a body, and then asking, you know, what is this? And how did this get here? how do all these pieces, work together? The kind of astrology that I learned, and that I think a lot of people who might be tuning in to a podcast on astrology in English about, and I know this is your, maybe not your second language. I don't know how many languages you speak, right? Okay, your second language. So, but still, that your mother tongue is Portuguese, right? And so a European dialect, a Romance language, a language that also goes back to the Roman, to the Greek, and to the Latin. And so those of us whose minds have been shaped, by Western thought are probably coming into exposure with astrology through Western astrology, through a tropical system of astrology. And the myths of tropical astrology have been mostly shaped in a very dominant way, in a conscious way, by the Roman myths and by the Greek myths. And the Greeks are part of the lineage of astrology, but astrology didn't start with them, right? And so they were working with myth that was Mesopotamian myth from Babylonia, from Sumer, from what is now present day Iran and Iraq, and the kind of basin of civilization in northern Africa and the Middle East and India and the Far East, from northern Western perspective. And these traditions also have their deeper anchors. And at some point, we're going to trace these lineages, all the way back to people who were in direct experience with the planets. First of all, with Earth, right? Direct experience, living inside of nature, not separated, in our apartment buildings, driving our cars, engaging with astrology through computer screens and software apps, but right there on the ground, experiencing in their bodies in a very profound and primal way what it is to move through the wheel of the zodiac, which is the year of seasons, what it is to observe the changing night sky as the constellations, move across the ecliptic in our visual experience, or to watch the wandering ones, the planets, right? The bright lights of the planets like Venus or Jupiter, literally moving across the sky, like swimming through the constellations. These were people who are having direct experiences of the lunar phases every single month, going through waxing and waning cycles, and feeling how that affects their bodies, their sleep, their dreams, menstrual cycles, how the animals at night, right? Like the frogs and the owls and like the night predators get really loud at the full moon, and having this direct experience, right? And it's from that place that then we start to tell stories, because story is the way that memory is transmitted. And storytelling is a deeply ancient craft of creating reality. And there are so many stories, within especially indigenous cosmologies, of the storytellers, right? Stories about the storytellers who create the world through their story. And those stories carry such profound intelligence. And that intelligence goes back to what we were talking about before with the subtle nature of observation and meditation. When you tune in with the subtle nature of observation, you recognize that attention flows like water, that it doesn't stop, that it's constantly moving around, but that wherever attention goes, energy builds. And so, if my attention is going towards a story of war, then what's going to build in my body is readiness for war. Whereas, if my attention is going towards a story of love, then what builds in my body is readiness for love. Imagining something starts to make it happen. When we imagine, our bodily processes, our emotional and physical and physiological processes get going with the imagination, right? They enact, they embody. And so the role of myth and storytelling is hugely important in human civilization. And for a, you know, humans are 250 million years old at this point in terms of our species age. The Earth is 4.5 billion years old. We've only actually been here for, I don't know what that math is. It's like 1/17th or something of the Earth's lifespan. The Earth is only halfway through its lifespan. Humans might be at the end of ours. I don't know. You know, we're going to see. But in terms of the evolution of human consciousness, for a long time, you know, humans traveled in small bands, right? Like small groups, maybe up to 100 people. And then something incredible happened, which allowed human beings to organize in exponentially larger numbers. And the thing that happened was a unification of stories, religions, philosophies, the ideas of gods, and then who gets to channel those gods, right? These heroes or divine incarnations of the gods themselves, the people, the human bodies that get the role in the story. And who gets to craft the story then crafts the power, right? And then, so we have stories emerging that shape civilization. And those stories are working with the phenomenology of Earth, which includes the planets, it includes the constellations, it includes the seasons. So we need to have stories about why there's summer and why there's winter. We need to have stories about why, you know, this person is born with these life circumstances while this other person is born with those life circumstances. We need to have stories about, you know, why these people get to have power and make the rules while those people have to be enslaved. And stories then are embedded into cultural fabric. So by the time astrology and its associated cosmologies and mythologies reach the Greeks, they're reaching a civilization and a culture that is emerging with a kind of thrust of patriarchy, right? And though the Greek pantheon includes, you know, both gods and goddesses, the Greeks were totally invested, you know, in uplifting male supremacy. And the Romans afterwards continued that investment. And while the Romans took over from the Greek cosmology and pantheon, the Romans also utilized the mythos of Christ and incorporated Christianity as the state religion. And in that incorporation began a now centuries-long project of religious terrorism and religious supremacy and a kind of colonization of land and bodies, of course, but also of imagination. And so the patriarchal Christian European mythos is very, very deeply embedded in a lot of the astrology that many of us have encountered, especially in the tropical astrology tradition. And so when I said before, you know, in our group reading on the Jupiter-Uranus conjunction, I think is what you're referencing, and I said, we're ready for new myths. You know, and this is something that our colleague Sherry Taylor has been working with a lot in her kind of reformation of the myth of Saturn. What I'm talking about is that the myths of the Greco-Roman traditions are fundamental myths driving a kind of societal evolution that uplifts male supremacy, Christian supremacy, European supremacy, which has become white supremacy. It uplifts cultures of dominance and war. And it uses mythology to normalize those kinds of experiences and behaviors, right? It uses mythology to paint a picture of heroism as like a, you know, muscle-bound man who's going to just like beat up everybody, you know, and take exactly what he wants and then go sit on his throne and fuck all the women that he wants and like be up there on his high horse. Like, that is the myth of success in dominant culture, but that's not success on earth, right? When you look at the planet that we actually are part of, when you look at what is successful on earth, and I'm not talking about human conceptions of success, because our notions of success have failed us to the point that we're at now, you know, where we're really looking at our own obliteration. So whatever mutation of the notion of success that humanity has been working with, I just want to toss in the garbage. When you look at what is an earthly success, you know, earthly success is biodiversity. Earthly success is like flourishing of complementary life forms that emerge in response to one another, and they all get to do their own thing. And they keep each other in balance. They keep each other in check. It's not like violence isn't there. Predators and prey exist. Life eats life. Death eats life, you know? But earthly success is luscious. It's weird. It is, you know, when we think about, like, you're talking about queer time, right? And like queerness as an adjective, but also as a verb, like that we can queer something. We are queering something. It's taking it outside of a straight and narrow. And an earthly definition of success is not straight and narrow. It's not a box. It's not 90 degree angles. It's not a highway grid plastered across, you know, swaths of land. It is fungi and molds. It's, you know, forests underneath the ocean. It's like bacteria inside of bacteria inside of bacteria, each one having its own kind of symbiotic process with the other so that some larger organism can become. And when you look back at, okay, well, where did some of our myths come from, right? Like, there are these older myths that we might be able to draw upon. So again, you know, Sherry is working with these older myths of Saturn. And so if we want to displace the current mythos of Saturn as a patriarchal, arrogant, you know, life-suppressing tyrant, you know, and somebody who wants to encapsulate time and linearity, if we want to displace Saturn from that, it's actually possible to remember myths of Saturn where Saturn is a mischievous, horny, artistic, you know, sea goat that goes to sleep at night in the ocean and comes out to work during the day by forming creatures out of a sense of profound humor and deep love and total devotion, where though there's asymmetries in balance, all the asymmetries in balance are meant to harmonize into a whole where everyone has enough. And in the needing to tell new myths, you know, there's also the need to understand what are the myths that we're even telling, because what happens with mythology, and especially, you know, with cultural mythology, and I would say astrology is part of a cultural mythology, is that it becomes normalized to the point that we don't even realize that that's what we're doing. And so again, it's like, oh, we live in modernity and in the, you know, Northern Western kind of mind, success looks like making $1 million or more and like having all this material wealth or something like that. And that's normal and nobody's questioning it. But what happens when we start to question it is that new stories emerge, new possibilities emerge, and we might feel like, oh, that concept that I have of what is success or what is happiness or what is love or what is female or what is male, you know, it's like all these concepts that we have, they start to fall apart which is what happens in the meditative experience, is we realize like, oh, there's no solidity in this. It's a living, evolving substance. How can we create myths that allow us to feel into the potentials for change and that also allow us to recognize what are the stories that we're telling? Because the stories that we're telling shape our reality. And astrology is such a wonderful way to reshape reality, you know, and to play with it. And I think especially now, it's a language that a lot of people have become attracted to and are playing with, and it serves to expand awareness of who a person is or how they might be, hopefully, and not to reduce it, you know, not all Virgo moons are the same, right? It's when we tune into, oh, what are these symbols? How do they live through me? Then we get to expand awareness of different parts and different ways that we might be. And can we use astrology to look at the stories that we're telling and then to investigate the roots of these stories, the potentials of these stories, and how they might re-become so that they can support us in imagining and then speaking into existence and then crafting with our bodies and our labor what new worlds might be possible. It's a long ramble for you. I don't know how long.
This is perfect. And it seems like the perfect moment to thinking about, like, you know, like Neptune at the last degree of Pisces, and, you know, the unforming and forming, and it just feels like the right moment to make these questions and understand, even if we create these new myths, or it's not so much about creation, but letting them grow, because I think creation is already here, and, you know, like, these myths, they exist already. And the thing about creating time is not like, it's not so much about like creating new ways of experiencing time, but like letting yourself experience time in different ways. So I feel that maybe creating new myths is exactly as you were saying. It's not about like sitting down and, you know, like writing a new story. But if we think about like how astrology is created as something that people were experiencing daily in their bodies and like observing, and we think about like what Sherry is doing, for example. Sherry is not like just, you know, like creating something from their heads about like what they think Saturn is, but like really deeply searching about like these other stories that were suffocated in order to like have this one story told. And I feel that, you know, like with Neptune, we can really use this time for, I don't know, the image that came in my mind was like my body transforming in this blob, you know, like a blob where like I can be in another form and allowing my body to be another form, actually hold other things. Yeah, and I feel that sometimes when I think about Neptune, this is what I kind of like imagine, because it is so difficult to imagine something visually that my visuals are always like blobs. Like, so, you know, like, anyway, and the other thing that I was thinking when you said, like, well, if we think about, like, if we assume that imagining is already creating, and the only thing we can imagine is war, this is what we're going to create. So one of the things that I research is archive, especially in photography. And I was thinking about like how to access archives that were not archived, because there is this thing about, and this happens to astrology too. One thing that we do is we go back and we say, okay, so let's try to imagine How's Neptune traveling at 29 Pisces? We go back and see like what was happening in other years that Neptune was traveling in this sign, in this degree. But what are the stories that were told, that were important to be told and to be maintained and to be archived? So it's very difficult when you are trying to like step out of something that you are so immersed and to imagine different things, which brings me to like this book from Vanessa Gerwetta called Hospice in Modernity, where Vanessa is saying that it is impossible, basically, it is impossible to like imagine futures that are not a continuation of what we have been doing, but just in a different form while we are inside of it, because this is the only thing we can imagine, which brings us back to like language, you know, like, and I feel that the image is also a language, you know, like the images that we create is a way of communicating. And even the saying of a picture worth 1,000 words, is that the same? Picture worth 1,000 words, more than 1,000 words. It's something that I think it's also related to like how we are so constrained, even though we think we know a lot and there is no capacity to know all of the things that we know. It's also like so little and so small compared to like all of the other possibilities. And the only way of like accessing these other possibilities is releasing this one that we are so like attached to. And you know, like with this comes also fear, because we are talking about something that we do not know how to imagine, which makes me think of like how Neptune is also associated with mysticism and yeah, everything that is not known, everything that is unknown, and everything that is like unconscious and that transcends what we can imagine. Yeah.
Yeah, I love that. What you're bringing up with hospicing modernity and this idea that from where we are, what we do is predicated, right? Like, I'm going to stand in relationship to where I sit. And the doingness, which I think she, this is a kind of core piece in her book, because I think she is talking about engaging with a meditative process as a hospicing process, to be with the dying of something, to be with what emerges, with the fear, with the unknown, to allow ourselves to feel what has been created gives us more choice than trying to avoid the feeling of it. And I think that so much of what has been created in modernity, and modernity being a construction of the European mind, the colonial mind in a lot of ways, or being a construction of the imperialist mind. So much of what has been created comes from a problematizing orientation, that something is wrong and or it's not right. And then we have to fix it. Right. And like there's this whole, it's like inside of the like kind of Judeo-Christian mythos, right, is a separation of light and dark, right? Heaven and hell. There's good and there's bad. There is like moral and immoral. That gets extrapolated into a separation between people with penises and people with vaginas, or a separation between human bodily forms and everything else that's earthly. And then there's as soon as there's separation, there's comparison, right? And then in this particular mythos, in the comparison, there's judgment and there's supremacy and there's a notion that something is bad and that the good will triumph over the evil, right? And like that means that then this group of people gets to do all of these things, bringing all their good, you know, whatever. It's like wiping out so
And
much.
also using always the same tools.
Right. And so again, it's like these stories create the reality. The stories create the lived experience. And so if you have an entire era, you know, a paradigm of people, of human consciousness, thinking about themselves as sinners, innately thinking, right, oh, my body is bad. Then what gets created out of that imagination? But, you know, ways to punish the body, incarcerate the body, mutate the body, you know, violate the body. It's get away from the body, get away from the bodily experience. And then we're spinning, you know, it's like faster and faster and faster and faster, trying to fix a problem that never even exists. Because again, from an earthly mythos place, our bodies are incredible. Like, how could you say that this living, breathing capsule of sentience that knows how to grow all of these different tissues, that has this deeply embedded curiosity and capacity to relate on multiple levels and to sense in many different ways, and then to express itself, you know, through dance, through song, through lovemaking, you know, to create like incredible food. Like human consciousness can do such amazing things if we were starting from a story of we're already creative and wonderful. And just like anything on earth, we're prone to imbalance and we can get overtaken by, you know, overgrowth of death-bringing substances or something like that. And part of our work then is to help ourselves and one another maintain harmonious balance. That's such a different story than everything is bad, or you know, the human body is bad or something like that. And so anyway, to go back to what you're talking about, you know, that we can't imagine outside of the paradigm. I would follow that up with, you know, until we allow ourselves to really feel what the paradigm is.
Exactly.
Right. And it's like, oh, when I practice meditation and I realize that my thoughts create my physical experience, when I learn lucid dreaming and I realize that when I focus on a thing in a dream, then the dream becomes that thing, then it's not such a far leap to recognize that, oh, in this phenomenal corporeal existence, you know, when I maneuver in such a way, when I speak like this, when I have this kind of vibe, there are consequences to that. And that completely shapes reality for me and for the people around me. And that will spill out beyond me and beyond the people around me because we affect each other in repetition and iteration. And so to do the work of recognizing, whoa, this is the experience, right, that we're having right now. This is the world that we have created. We've created a world where genociding people is normal. It's talking about Neptune, right? Like, if we go back to the last time Neptune was at the anaretic degree, at the last degree of Pisces, that was a time in the United States where the Indian Wars, the wars on indigenous people, on the indigenous people of Turtle Island, were in full throttle. You know, in that year, in 1875, that was a year when I pulled it up on my phone because I don't have the, but the majority of the apologize for my mispronunciation, the Yavapai and the Dilse or the Apache people tribes are forced by the United States cavalry to walk at gunpoint 180 miles from their traditional homelands, you know, to be resettled onto a plot of, you know, it's like the cultural imagination of the United States, which is to completely separate people from land, separate people inside of their communities, and say, oh, you get this place. These are the walls. This is your private property. You know, like this is what a family looks like. This is what labor should look like. You know, that this is what was happening in the cultural imagination the last time Neptune was at this degree. And here we are in 2024, witnessing the colonial project evolving, you know, ongoing in its evolution, where the United States is now funding the genocide of Palestinians through the mechanization of the Zionist, you know, war machine. We can't change that by reacting to it, right? Like there's a lot of reactive revolutionary force, right? That it feels like a counterforce, but it's not, because it's still violent. And I'm not saying that it's like nonviolence is the only way. Clearly, it's like nonviolence can't work when people are trying to obliterate you with violence. But we're not going to reach some new kind of imagination just by meeting force with force. And so a lot of the work, you know, that we're doing at Embodied Astrology, that people are doing all over the world, has to do with this. Can we feel what's actually happening right now? Can we feel the level of devastation that is being caused by these cultural mythologies? Can we feel the interconnections between military and climate? Because if we can feel them, then we can have some agency inside the story. But if we can't feel them and we're just trying to like rush to whatever we think is, you know, going to be better than this from this place of activation and reactivation constantly, like you said, you know, it's just, we're just spinning our wheels. We're just creating the same thing over and over. But Allah hospicing modernity, you know, modernity will suicide itself. And that's what's happening. You know, we're in the moment of the death force of this cultural construction, and we might not survive, right? And that's part of the Sabian symbol, right? Of the anaretic degree of Neptune, is that this is the point when the cycle is coming to a close and the seeds of the new cycle have already been planted and they're already starting to burst forth in their next iterations. But they, you know, they're going through the passage of something. And so any dying process is a birthing process, but not all birthing processes will be allowed. And if the last cycle was such a failure that the organism dies as it's trying to birth the new thing, then that's the end of the story. And humanity might have gotten ourselves here, you know, like the dream of what humanity could be has been pretty paltry for a long time, you know, at least for several thousand years in terms of the dominant, you know, driving mind.
Yeah. And I feel there is a difference between, like, you know, like nature is furious. There is this ferocity in nature, but it's different than violence. And when we talk about like nonviolence, people often think about like, well, you have to be passive and don't react and, you know, like ignore and lay down. And this makes me think about Neptune, the planet, you know, like it's this ice giant together with Uranus. And between all of the planets, Neptune is the one that has the highest wind speeds. And if you think about this, so these are hurricanes. And this is like the opposition of like tranquility. And it is ferocity, but it doesn't need to be violent, if that makes sense. So I'm just thinking about like how we have to stop thinking about things as like these binary oppositions. And just to come back a bit to what we were saying at the beginning of like the universe and the oneness and meditation and all of that, I was imagining this thing of like, so because of all of this hard winds that exist in Neptune, and like the winds are so strong that they can break the sound barrier, looks really, really strong. And I was just thinking about like, is it, it feels enormous to us. But then when I think about a small being, like ant, and I blow, like, this is enormous for this being. And the thing about us humans is that we are always comparing things to ourselves. So when we think about like, oh my God, it's like it's inhospitable. It is inhospitable for one type of life that we are thinking about, like us, like ourselves. And when you're saying about like, modernity is suiciding itself. It's just like this, like we really need to, and this is where fear comes up, because we need to allow it to die.
Yes.
If we don't, and we are not allowing it to die because we are so attached to like this comforts, that are not comfortable. They are just not comfortable. It's like it's so bizarre how we are attached to things that are not making us good. And I'm talking about all of us. And of course, some people are living lives that are way more comfortable than others, but it is still like in a spiritual level, not comfortable.
It's highly uncomfortable. I mean, I would imagine that, especially for the people who are the most financially and materially resourced, that in some ways those folks have the highest levels of discomfort because there's the most buffering from the actual world and the unpredictability of the world. You know, the more money you have, the more scared you are of losing your money. And it's, you know, I don't know how many times somebody needs to do a study to show this,
Save
right?
it.
It's like, you know, when there's a need for something, it's like, oh, there's a disaster somewhere, right? And now there's a need. Send aid. The people who overwhelmingly send the most aid are the people who have the least resources. And the people who have the most resources give the least over and over and over and over and over again. And you know, the more inflated your sense of personal possession and attachment is, the less relational you are. And I think that that's, you know, that's part of this thing around like the Neptunian awareness of the everythingness of the interconnection. That's relationality, right? Like that's being a part of something. And on the, you know, level of like thinking about planetary symbolism with the outer planets, some astrologers will talk about like different frequencies, right? And that Neptune is a higher frequency of Venus. And so Venus, as a symbol of the connecting force, the relational force, and sweetness, right? Like, what is life really about? You know, why do we stick it out? You know, even if it's completely delusional, even if we're creating our own suffering, everybody wants a little sweetness. You know, that's why we keep going. Is sweetness or the promise of sweetness? That Venus is the substance of life, right? And so then Neptune is a higher octave of Venus is going, you're connected to everything. And imagine the sense of sweetness in your spirit that would be possible if you could just recognize that all your needs are met, right? The feeling of, ah, oh, all my needs are met on a caliber that's 1,000 times, 1,000,000 times bigger than what you can imagine having all your needs met would feel like. You know, people who become obsessed with possession are people who cannot comprehend that their needs are met, right? They're hungry ghosts, they're devouring spirits, they're cannibalistic. They'll destroy every single thing around them in order to own it, and they still won't fucking be satisfied. Whereas people who don't have a lot are forced to share and rely upon one another. And that's wealth. And so, of course, you know, if someone is in need, I'm going to be a friend indeed, right? Because giving, the actual act of generosity, is meeting some of my own needs, which is to feel alive, you know, to feel relational, to feel a part of something.
Which makes me think about like Saturn being, like the less visible planet, Sure, naked eye, and this clear, boundary of like this is the last one. And then, although Neptune is the last planet that we know of in our
Whatever's
solar
classified as
system,
planets,
yeah, classified as planet. Sorry, Pluto.
yeah. Sorry, Pluto. We don't get to use planet anymore.
But I was thinking really about this. Although it is the last one, we are not sure if it's the last one because we're still arguing if Pluto is a planet, if like all the if there is another planet, if all the other objects in the Kuiper belt are like in this account, like, and how Neptune and these other objects are in relation to each other in a way of like Neptune is actually influencing the orbit of these objects, and this like this strong reciprocity that they must have in order to continue spinning, in order to continue their traveling. And also, like, yeah, I was just thinking, I've been thinking a lot about Saturn because Saturn is also in Pisces, and there is the great conjunction coming of Saturn and Neptune in Aries. And there is, of course, this big difference of like Saturn representing formation and Neptune representing the unforming. And one thing that I think it's beautiful is that, well, there are two things. I'll say this first. How Neptune is related to illusion. And until last year, we thought Neptune was like this deep blue. And now we know the color is different than we thought. We don't even know if this is the real color. We can question everything from, astronomy. But yeah, because what is reality anyway? But yeah, just thinking about like, wow, it's known for more than a century, and only last year that people are like, oh wait. And because I was studying a lot, like on Neptune, I keep finding all of these explanations about the deep blue color, and I'm like, this is so interesting. All of these explanations about this thing that is untrue.
That's right. We'll find what we need to back up our stories.
Exactly. And then the other thing that I was going to say is that because of the ice and the clouds and the interior that is, I don't know, 2500 degrees Celsius or something, and the minus, I don't know how much degrees, like in the outer atmosphere, there are no boundaries between like what is actually the mantle and what is the atmosphere, which is very different than the Earth, for example, that we can see, like this is the surface. And yeah, I was just thinking about like this, really how the planet itself is a representation of like what we cannot measure, because there is no like, even the distance, the grandiosity of Neptune, I don't know, like it's difficult for me to like assume the information I'm reading are real because I'm talking about in
Right.
realness.
But you're talking about the fiction of Western science also, which,
Exactly.
it posits itself as having the grasp on reality and the truth, but science is always changing its story.
And also like what we understand about reality is the fiction.
That's right.
So when I talk about the non-reality, I'm not saying that things don't exist. I'm just saying that, like the explanations of the existence may not be what we think they are.
Right.
And we have to question them.
Right. And this is where, I love your series, for working with photography and staging and, the creation of images and also the editing and the manipulating of images in order to tell stories. Because you're working with this notion that what we imagine becomes what we believe, right? And then we believe our thoughts. One of humanity's biggest failings is that we believe our thoughts, and we believe them
Exactly.
to be true. And again, to go back to the practice of meditation, it's like very quickly you'll learn that your thoughts are figments, right? Like your thoughts are, it's like turning the radio dial, they're fragments. A lot of them are echoes and regurgitations of somebody else's thoughts, of society's thoughts. They're grasping at trying to make sense of what is beyond comprehension. They're stories that we tell ourselves to make ourselves feel better and feel stable about something. But when we get attached to our thoughts, then we're attached to suffering. It's like we believe something is true, and then we've limited it. And it's kind of, I feel like the notion of post-truth, like this, one of your focuses for the class, is terrifying to a lot of people right now. And it's truly a bizarre time to be living in, where there's so much propaganda, there's so much fabrication of reality and intentional distortion of experiences and manipulation of words and images and ideas very intentionally, to create imaginations to then get people to do something, right? To craft some kind of behavior. It's like, again, the role of religion, like that religion has played, religion can no longer hold that, because people don't, aren't willing in the same way to all believe in the same thing. And so now these technologies, it's like, what is artificial intelligence? It's one way to create artifice of intelligence, to build something inside of a collective imagination. And if we're interacting with it all the time, if we're interacting with technologies that have been built by certain imaginations that then want to get imaginations to imagine something, we're very susceptible to those manipulations. But we can also tune in with post-truth as an opportunity, right? And
Exactly.
like the opportunity of post-truth is to do this work of being inside of an experience, and from inside the experience, playing with what it is and what we want it to be. And I forget, what's that metaphor? It's like you have however many people who are blind or blindfolded, trying to describe an elephant, and one person's holding the tusk, and one person's got the tail, and one person's got their hand on the side. And everybody's trying to describe the same thing, but everybody's going to describe it differently and from a different place. And I feel like the need of consciousness at this time, when I tune in with my story that I'm telling, I think human consciousness has been fractured by fundamentalism, right? By like dogmas and ideas that seek to homogenize human consciousness and say it's like this, whether that's Christianity, whether that's science, whether that's the apocalypse, it like doesn't matter. It's like there are these dominant stories that, big forces are trying to get lots of people to agree to. And the truth of nature is that nature is chaotic in a very creative way, right? And this thing over here is responding to like all these different influences and meeting them in the moment and changing right then and there. That's evolution. And if we seek to emulate that, it's totally terrifying to the parts of our consciousness that want predictability and that want to be able to like retire at 55 years old and have this particular kind of home and do this kind of thing. It's like those are the stories in our heads about what we should want.
Exactly.
But in a post-truth reality, anything that we are thinking of right now as the be-all end-all dissolves. And then what's possible? So from inside this particular moment, what's possible? And what are the stories that we're telling about it? And if we're in this place that you're inviting us into, which is to feel how we construct reality by telling stories, by looking at pictures, by framing, by expressing, yes, it's poetic. Yes, it's an art project. Yes, it's fun and fictional, but it's also practicing, and engaging ourselves in actually practical ways with shaping reality. The most practical that we can be actually is skillful with our imagination in terms of like practical skills. If we can be skillful with our imagination, we can be skillful on planet Earth.
Exactly. It brings me back to, the Earth is pregnant with alternate futures. It's kind of like tapping into these different imaginations and feeling that they are there already. Kind of
Yes.
like a meditative practice of like tapping into these different imaginations. And what, this only possibility of truth that is told us to do is actually curious, because if you're telling me there is only this possibility, this creates this ambiguity of like, well, I'm seeing, like if you stay with nature a bit, just a bit, you understand that queerness is real, and there is all this diversity. I don't like to use this word, so I'm kind of like, I don't know what word to use, but it's diverse, like it's different. And if you're telling me there is only
Change.
one way, sorry,
Variability, changeability,
variability.
adaptability, creativity.
Variability is great. So, and you're telling me there is only this way, but then I'm seeing that in all of the other things in life, there are variabilities. It means that it must have a variability of what you're telling me,
That's right.
and I should seek for it.
That's right.
Yeah, I'm really excited for this lab because, like I'm just one person and I have my thoughts and they are limited too. So one of the things that I really wanted was like to share a bit of what I've been thinking, but also like to hear and receive. Because if I'm the person touching, just this part of the elephant, how will I know the whole elephant? And this is the thing about oneness, right? Is like, I can be not seeing what you're telling me you are seeing and respect and absorb and, use this piece of the puzzle into my own puzzle. It doesn't mean exactly agreeing, but it means like allowing this to exist, to coexist. Yeah, I feel this is a perfect ending for this conversation.
Every ending is a beginning, Gabs.
Exactly. It's kind of like the ending, but the beginning of the Nebula Lab.
Yeah, you taught a series with embodied astrology last year that was just so incredible. I know that it was one of the most successful experiments at this point that embodied astrology has had around, true embodiment and a kind of experiential learning of astrology and the way that you used photography and self-portraiture to bring people into an experiment of their own chart placements and what they could do with those placements was it was just so fun and it was so rich. And I'm really curious to see what comes through with the Nebula Lab because, I know that these kinds of conversations are going to get to have a lot of space and like you said, the earth is pregnant with alternate futures or an abundance of all kinds of futures. And human beings will embody some of those futures, but not all of them. And yeah, I think any amount of expanding imagination that we can do at this point brings us to closer proximity with the kinds of futures that I certainly hope that we get to live in.
Thank you. I'm excited too. I feel it's going to be as special as the self-report directions with this difference of like instead of like self-portraiture, you know, like portraiture of the self. I feel this time we'll be working much more with like using the self to go beyond the self.
Thank you for this invitation.
You for accepting it. And has always make my head explode a bit.